Sudan has been at war for 9 months. At least 12,000 people have been killed, perhaps 9 million displaced. There have been many plausible reports of crimes against humanity, mostly, though not exclusively, committed by the rebel Rapid Support Forces led by renegade General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, better known by the nom de guerre Hemeti. It is a big war with ramifications beyond Sudan's borders. Among the foreign powers involved at barely one remove are Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Russia. This is to say nothing of Sudan's key strategic position in the always volatile Horn of Africa. But though it is a big war, it has not been, at least in Western media, a big story. Give or take an amount of curiosity when hostilities began last April, Sudan has struggled for attention. It is obviously the case that this is partly due to competition from a major land war in Europe and a conflagration in the Middle East. But Sudan's is hardly the first African conflict to have raged disregarded by the West. Wars in the Democratic Republic of Congo between 1996 and 2003 killed upwards of 6 million people, directly involved the militaries of several other countries, and if you wanted to read about it, you really had to go looking. Why are Africa's wars reckoned less interesting or important than others? Does a lack of media coverage cause a dwindling of diplomatic energy? And might things be different if we were paying more attention? This is the Foreign Desk.
It's a mistake not to pay that much attention to them. The Sahel, the whole of sub-Saharan Africa, gets ignored until ISIS turn up and it becomes a huge terrorist problem. And suddenly Britain thinks, well, we better help the French out in French West Africa over the terrorism. So, you know, it is a mistake not to focus on it in the longer term, but I understand why it happens.
I feel like I spend all my time trying to explain to people. Nobody wants charity. This isn't yet another African shithole country where this is entrenched. This is a consequence of Western leaders, supposed good actors, not doing their job. It is a consequence of bad actors being allowed to get away with it.
You're listening to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller, and I'm joined first of all from Washington, D.C. by Ismael Kushkush, a Sudanese-American journalist who was based in Khartoum for 8 years. Ismael, first of all, is there any argument that Sudan's war began, even partially, because of the lack of attention paid to actual or potential African conflicts?
I think fundamentally it is the Sudanese actors themselves that need to be looked at and critiqued, and their role. This current conflict comes after a revolution in 2019 that deposed the 30-year rule of dictator Omar al-Bashir, and what was supposed to be a transitional period. There were multiple political actors in the Sudanese scene, whether domestically, regionally, or internationally, trying to navigate a transition with that many actors was going to be difficult. There was and is some international and regional involvement. The quality, the effectiveness of that involvement, I think, is what we can criticize or evaluate. And its links to other issues in the region, I think, is where we can point fingers at. Sudan, I think, has never been the top priority of major regional and international actors, but it is important to the regional actors that are important to those factors. So it becomes something of a bargaining chip, a part of a package of diplomacy, you might say.
You're quite right to put the primary amount of the blame for this conflict on actors within Sudan. And I do think there is arguably an amount of narcissism that besets the West when it starts thinking that we could solve all the world's problems if only we were minded to. But were there potentially any interventions, especially early on in the conflict, which might have stopped things escalating to the extent that they have?
There was, of course, a degree of involvement by the United Nations, by the African Union, by IGAD, United States, the UK, Norway, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and of course, Egypt always plays a role in Sudanese politics. Whether or not something could have been, again, I think it really fundamentally has to do with the domestic actors and their willingness to move or try to have moved the transition forward. I mean, many of us are still speaking in the language of before April 15th, before the war started. And, you know, 8-9 months into this war, I think matters are still not completely clear. It can go into any direction as the war widens and you have new actors coming in. But I think it really was to look, I mean, at the end of the day, if there was something to blame in Sudanese politics, it is the militarization of politics, that the barrel of the gun, tanks become the decisive factor, or perceived to be the decisive factor in settling issues. How those weapons, the sources of those weapons, the funding, and what international links that they may have, I think is where you could see a role of regional international players as one element, as one side to trying to come with some solution to the conflict, or even before the war actually started.
We did see Germany's foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, in Kenya this week, and she said that she would be focusing on Sudan. But if we look at the position as it currently is there actually anything that outside, especially Western powers, could do to bring fighting to a close? Or does this now just have to be played out, for better or for worse, by those Sudanese protagonists?
Historically, regional and international players have played a role in finding some solution to Sudan's conflicts, going back to the Addis Ababa Agreement in the early 70s that ended the civil war, then between North and South, to the Naivasha Agreement, to the multiple agreements on Darfur. So I think there can be some role of international players, but it becomes, I think, focusing on making Sudan's peace, or the attempts to reach a lasting peace, the center of any negotiations. I think a concern that many in Sudan seem to have with regional players is when other issues become a part of this bargain, so to speak. The EU, for example, which of course has its own interest, migration, flow of migration, refugees. What role does that play in trying to reach a peace in Sudan in discussions either with Sudanese actors or Sudan's neighbors? Security, extremism, what role does that play in Western views or attempts to reach some sort of agreement with Sudanese actors or its neighbors? I think helping Sudanese political actors reach an agreement on their own terms, besides these other interests that international players have, I think is really what should be the center of any hopeful negotiated peace in Sudan.
But that prospect aside, do you get any sense yet of how this war might end? We have recently seen Hemeti, the rebel general, undertaking something of a diplomatic tour of other countries in Africa. Does the willingness of those African countries to receive him suggest that they are, if not actually ecstatic about the prospect of Hemeti and his RSF winning a victory, that they're kind of resigned to it?
I think the RSF has been successful in portraying and presenting itself as an important player, not only militarily, but even whether through its media, through its diplomatic efforts, even before the war. The RSF was semi-independent even before the war, and clearly it is independent, and it is able to present itself in a way that regional players take it seriously. Hemeti's visit to Sudan's neighbors, to South Africa, I think make these countries take him seriously. On the other side, I think the Sudanese army's unwillingness to be directly involved, to engage in proposals to bring these two generals together, I think also sends a message. And at the end of the day, I think many of these countries will be looking at their own interest and where they see things falling in Sudan. The RSF has been responsible for much of the atrocities that have taken place since April 15th, but it is also clearly capable and in using language that presents itself as a serious player. I think at this point, it's really difficult to say where things are completely going. Many have compared Sudan to a Libya scenario, possibly an Afghanistan scenario in the 90s, where you have a vacuum in the country, or even a Yemen-like scenario. I think these are all possibilities. And different countries, I think, at the end of the day, will seek their own interest and connect to the parties that they where they see their interest lies.
Finally, then, and to bring it back to the overarching theme of this episode, which is the idea that this conflict in Sudan, as African conflicts often do, is rather struggling for the attention of the world's media and its audience. Why do you think that is? Why do we seem to accord less importance to African conflicts?
So I think there are a number of issues. One specifically on Sudan. The war has resulted in the freezing of the work of journalists. Many journalists have fled with their families. Scores of media outlets, newspapers, radio stations have stopped. The ability of ground producers to work with international media has stopped. The government in Port Sudan, my understanding, hasn't issued visas to international journalists who wish to visit the country. The security situation is difficult for journalists. Electricity, the internet, all of these very practical matters, I think, have been a challenge. But also, I mean, I think it's important to remember that Khartoum isn't a media hub. It's not Cairo. It's not Nairobi. It's not Jerusalem. There weren't many international journalists to begin with. There were some regional bureaus in Khartoum, but you didn't have a great number of international journalists in Khartoum to begin with. The other issue, of course, is that world's attention, whether media or policymakers or humanitarians, has shifted with the war in Gaza. And for the past 3 months or so, much of the attention has been to Gaza. So journalists that may have normally been interested in covering Sudan have been focusing on other places. The editorial policies of different media outlets that see in the war in Gaza as a priority to cover, whether for their audiences or for other reasons, I think has played an important role in Sudan not getting the coverage that it deserved. There was some coverage, in the beginning, back in April and May, but that dwindled over the following months. In the past weeks, I think we're starting to see something of a resurgence of interest in Sudan, almost with many articles, the same headline, the forgotten war, the war that the people forgot. You know, I think that there is some recognition that what is happening in Sudan is of great importance. I mean, given the fact that, you know, this is the largest number of displaced persons in the world today is from Sudan, over 7 million, over a million refugees in two neighboring countries, millions displaced domestically. The number of deaths, the numbers that we've seen is up to 12,000, probably more, I think, given the fact that there really hasn't been the means to account for an accurate number. There were some good investigations, I think, into some of the atrocities that took place in Darfur, especially West Darfur and Jenina. But I'm sure that there's still an opportunity for journalists to do greater investigations, for there to be more coverage of events in Sudan.
Ismail Kushkush, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Foreign Desk. This is The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller. For a look now at the diplomatic ramifications of this indifference, I'm joined now by Sir William Patey, a former British diplomat who served as the UK's ambassador to Afghanistan, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and Sudan. Sir William, going back specifically to your experience as the UK's ambassador to Sudan, did it seem to you at the time that African wars got noticeably less coverage than European or Middle Eastern ones?
Well, when I was in Sudan, there weren't any European wars, thankfully. Certainly, they got less coverage than the Middle East generally. Indeed, when I went to Sudan, we were in the middle of a an effort combined with the Americans and Norwegians to bring an end to the Sudanese civil war after many, you know, after almost 50 years of war. And I was struck at the time when I went as ambassador that it wasn't really high on the Foreign Office's agenda, the British Foreign Office's agenda. It was DFID at the time who were most interested, and they were the ones actually funding the peace process. So at that time, it wasn't top of the FCO's agenda in a way that the Middle East nearly always is, and European affairs certainly were at the time. And so later on, of course, when we began to make progress and the comprehensive peace agreement was in prospect, the Foreign Office took more of an interest, but that probably was a result of an upswing in the violence in Darfur.
I mean, it is unarguably the case right now, though, that certainly from where we're sitting in Europe, the conflict in Sudan is attracting the meagerest fraction of the attention that Ukraine and Israel are consuming. Where did you come down on why that is?
Well, I think, you know, it's a reflection of how much media interest. Ministers are influenced by the media, whether it's in the forefront. It's also a matter of where each country sees their vital national interests. The French are much more interested in French-speaking West Africa. Britain gets interested in the Commonwealth countries, in Kenya, in Tanzania. And it depends on where your interests are seen. I mean, nowadays, people are interested in Rwanda because it's front and centre of the immigration debate. So it's based on a factor of national interest. Is your economy at stake? There's no oil in many of those places, although Nigeria is a big oil producer. It has close links with Britain. From time to time, we get sucked into caring about African countries, usually on the back of some terrorist massacre or kidnap of young schoolgirls in Nigeria. So from time to time, we get sucked in. But on a day-to-day basis, you know, you're right, European affairs and relationships with China, the Middle East, tend to be the centre of gravity of British foreign policy.
When we think back to your experience as ambassador to Sudan around 2002 to 2005, would it have made any difference to your job in terms of making it either easier or harder if you'd had the BBC, CNN, Sky, all the others all over it day in, day out like they are over Israel and Gaza right now and were in Ukraine a couple of years ago?
Well, we did for a while. When the Darfur affair was at its height in 2003, the BBC and other media were all over it. So, you know, they dip in and out. In many ways, that kind of made my job harder because we were trying to end the civil war between the North and South. And Darfur was a complication, undoubtedly. We were quietly getting on with trying to end the civil war. That was better done not in the glare of publicity. So in many ways, the publicity over Darfur was a complicating factor, made it more complex, made the interlocutors we're dealing with more difficult. So there's no hard and fast rule here.
Did it, in your experience, though, make it harder to attract the attention of politicians back in London if the conflict you were in the middle of wasn't on the news every day?
I think that is true. You don't get the ministerial attention. The capacity for ministers to focus on too many things at once is limited. They're human beings. They focus on the things that are either causing them, they're having to answer questions in the House of Commons, they're having to answer constituents' letters, they're having to make statements, they're having to attend international meetings where these are discussed. So it's a complex factor. When Rhodesia was around, I'm old enough to remember when Zimbabwe was called Rhodesia, there was a lot of focus on Africa then, a lot of focus on apartheid. And so that was a big focus of attention because the public were engaged. The public were engaged over the injustice of apartheid. They were engaged over the white minority rule in Rhodesia. Britain had a huge interest. It was an ex-colonial country. So there was a period in the 70s and early 80s when there was a big focus on Africa. But the Middle East has a sort of regular tendency every decade or so to pull you back to it with a war or, you know, it's not unrelated to oil and our strategic interests and our trade interests. Individual African countries rarely command that sort of attention because they're one of 50. They rarely sit astride a great trade route. Their problems rarely affect us on a visceral or a strategic basis.
This is what I was wondering just finally. Is it a mistake to assume that what is happening in Sudan right now actually does matter less than what is happening in Ukraine and the Middle East?
Well, I think it does matter because, you know, we have a huge Sudanese diaspora here. If you think that immigration is front and center of the agenda in terms of the issues that people worry about in this country at the moment, we should be worried about Africa because that's, you know, Sudan, Eritrea, Ethiopia, Somalia, countries in West Africa. These are areas which large numbers of people want to come to Europe. So it's and they come via Libya. So it's a mistake not to pay that much attention to them. But I understand why it happens. The Sahel, the whole of sub-Saharan Africa gets ignored until ISIS turn up and it becomes a huge terrorist problem. And suddenly Britain thinks, well, we better help the French out in French West Africa over the terrorism. So it is a mistake not to focus on it in the longer term, but I understand why it happens.
Sir William Patey, thank you very much for joining us here on the Foreign Desk on Monocle Radio. You're listening to the Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller. And joining me now from London is Nema El-Baga, CNN's chief international investigative correspondent. Nema has reported on numerous conflicts across Africa, including wars in Ethiopia, the Central African Republic, and in her birthplace of Sudan. Nema, this episode is an examination of that relative lack of coverage often afforded to African wars. How frustrating do you find this as a Sudanese-born journalist?
Well, I think as a journalist and as a Sudanese person, what that does is that projects onto these African wars that there is no resolution, because what coverage does is it explains to people how we got here, why we're here, what it would take to untangle this. You know, these are not inherently intractable wars. It just starts to feel like they are for the general public, whether it's here or in the US, because they're like, haven't I been hearing about this for some time and it still hasn't been resolved? It's this vicious kind of self-fulfilling narrative. I also would say that having, what is it, 2.5 decades of doing this kind of work, no matter the extent of the empathy and the relationships that I have built with the people that we have covered and the sense that I had that perhaps I had a tiny glimpse into what they were going through, I don't think, knowing now what I know, that it is possible until it is your family and these are your friends and it is your country. The last 9 months have felt like two parallel time zones. There's like normal time where you go into the office and, oh, it's Christmas and, oh, it's January, we started. Oh, 2024 came around quickly. And then there's this other time zone where time moves like treacle and it feels like we've been stuck in this for an eternity.
I appreciate in advance that there probably isn't a short answer to the question of why different conflicts attract such different amounts of attention, but it is the case that there have been in recent years, or there are going on now, huge conflicts in Sudan, Ethiopia, Yemen, Syria, which attracted vastly less coverage than wars in Ukraine and the one you have just been reporting from in Israel. And that's obviously not to say that Ukraine and Israel are not colossally important stories. They are, but there is a disproportion, isn't there?
Well, access is key, as you know. We like it when we can get into somewhere. And I think bad actors have learned that all they have to do is obstruct access. Saudi Arabia, they say that they aren't the final arbiters of who gets an Aden visa, but they are. So deciding who gets to go in, limiting that flow of access and information. But also, I think it's interesting that you mentioned Tigray, Sudan, and now what's happening in Israel and Palestine, because I think they are all foreign policy failures. I think it's also about the fact that those in power, whether it's the Biden administration in the US or it's our rotating list of prime ministers here in the UK, we really have not been blessed with any kind of foreign policy. I'm not even asking for geniuses. It's interesting. Tigray, the Biden administration, made a genocide finding. They then, after we kept harassing them And when I say we, our colleagues in DC, we all made ourselves very, very annoyed. They finally acknowledged publicly that they had decided to pause the release of the genocide designation to give peace a chance, i.e. to give their outreach to Abiy Ahmed and Ethiopian government a chance. It took just over a year after that point for a peace agreement to be signed. And by then, The Lancet, the medical journal here in the UK, they put out their findings 5 or 6 months after that peace deal. And they found that over the lifespan of the conflict, a year of which was kind of artificially extended by the foreign policy choices of the Biden administration, almost half of the women in Tigray had been subjected to some form of sexual violence. So I think we also have to be honest about the fact that when there is no momentum, Secretary Blinken comes up every once in a while and he has his concerned face on, and he does this often. I'm concerned, but we are going to veto the ceasefire vote in the UN Security Council. I am concerned, but we are only going to sanction the deputy head of the Rapid Support Forces, the militia, which we have found and many others have found is guilty of so many of the atrocities in Sudan and previously implicated in genocidal acts. We're only going to sanction the deputy head because they have a great relationship with one of our key allies, the United Arab Emirates. We've just been stuck. We've been mired, I think, in a lot of very, very bad foreign policy. When there's bad foreign policy, there's nothing to kind of move the story on.
I know it's not the job of news organizations necessarily to create a momentum towards better foreign policy, much less, heaven help us, actually draft foreign policy. But just as every journalist knows that your presence in a particular place, you being there with a camera, with a notepad, with a tape recorder, changes things. It shifts the dynamic. People act differently for better and for worse than they would if there was no press present. Does an absence of coverage also change a conflict, do you think?
Absolutely. I would say that in Sudan, we are lucky in that there is a huge Sudanese diaspora and the Sudanese on the ground have been very, very vocal. It may be one of the few good things that can be said about Twitter in that it has provided this huge platform to hold people to account. But I think if it wasn't for that, then this would be another story of a war criminal, a very much a 1980s throwback to the warlords of days gone by, was being willingly accepted by the international community. He still has great relationships with the United Arab Emirates. He did a little tour of Africa. He had the audacity to visit the Rwandan genocide memorial. And even worse, Paul Kagame had the audacity to allow him to stand there and pay his respects to the victims. If it wasn't for the constant drumbeat of the Sudanese and some allies online, I think he would have already been coronated.
Just finally then, and this is where we will shamelessly prevail on your expertise on Sudan while we have you here. The warlord you're referring to is, of course, General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, better known as Hameti, the commander of the Rapid Support Forces. You've met him at least once, I think. What's your view of why he has started this? Is this proceeding according to his plan?
I think he would have liked it to be over sooner. He would have liked less of his lucrative companies to be sanctioned. But I don't think that you spend years becoming arguably one of Africa's richest men not to want to be a dictator. And I think people forget Sudan borders around 7 countries in Africa. It also has that key vantage point overlooking the Suez. And the United Arab Emirates, which is a key backer of Hameti and Russia via Wagner militia proxy, have wanted a perch on the Suez. They have wanted to have a port in Port Sudan for some time. But what Hameti does for a lot of these bad actors, whether it's Russia or how the United Arab Emirates is currently behaving, is he gives them a connection across Africa. So if you have Sudan, you have Port Sudan, you have the ability to disrupt trade through the Suez, which we all remember what happened when that massive cargo ship got stuck in there and everything got very expensive briefly. So can you imagine? But he also, his tribe is one of those transnational North African Arab tribes. So he has tribal and kinship links that connect all the way to the western coast of Africa. So if you install him and you support him, then suddenly you have this extraordinary extended influence. right? And so I kind of feel like I'm, you know, slightly like a Jehovah's Witness ringing your doorbell and saying, I've come to tell you about the word. I feel like I spend all my time trying to explain to people. Nobody wants charity. This isn't yet another African shithole country where this is entrenched. This is a consequence of Western leaders, supposed good actors, not doing their job. It is a consequence of bad actors being allowed to get away with it. And the consequences for this, if he becomes president, are not just going to be felt by the Sudanese people. You're going to have this axis of bad actors. You know, you've got Haftar in Libya, and that should matter, and people should care. And I think they will when their, you know, cherry tomatoes or whatever it is start getting more expensive because Russia starts monkeying about on the Suez. It baffles me that it is not being taken more seriously. And I do sometimes wonder whether it is useful for many Western leaders to put their hands up and go, oh no, another intractable African conflict. What could we possibly do? Well, you could have done more than just evacuate your citizens and then leave the Sudanese people to die.
Nema Elbaga, thank you very much for joining us here on The Foreign Desk on Monocle Radio. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Emma Searle and Christy O'Grady. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. To contact the Foreign Desk team, you can email Emma at es@monocle.com. And don't forget to subscribe to Monocle magazine and our free daily email bulletins by heading to our website, monocle.com. From me, Andrew Muller, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.